Hi, welcome to Ryan Talks Tax, a podcast to keep you up to date on the latest developments in Canadian tax and government funding. And today, we're going to talk about a tax rule that is essentially a form of government funding. I'm Jim Day. Of course, I'm talking about scientific research and experimental development and the tax credit related to that. You'll often hear it referred to as SR&ED or SR&ED, but it's a very important program that can provide funding for innovation that's taking place in an organization. Unfortunately, many organizations who are eligible for the funding might be missing out, and that's due in part to some misconceptions that are often held about the Scientific Research and Experimental Development Tax Credit. In this episode, I'm hoping to debunk some of the common myths about SR&ED, and to help me do it, I'm joined by three of the leaders of Ryan's SR&ED practice in Canada, David Douglas and Brian Cardinal, both principals, and Jeffrey Stewart, a senior manager from the group. You're all returning guests to the podcast. Welcome back, everyone.
Hey, Jim. Yeah.
Okay, well, before we tackle some of those myths I was talking about, maybe you can quickly remind us what the SR&ED program is. David?
Well, thanks, Jim. Yeah, the SR&ED program has been around since the mid-80s and was originally designed to bring U.S. parent companies to do R&D in Canada and to build up our capacity as it relates to R&D. Since then, it's been Canada's largest innovation support program, and it supports companies that are developing new products, process, and incrementally improving their technology, know-how, capabilities. It's a tax credit program, meaning it's part of the Income Tax Act, meaning everybody is allowed to get it as long as you are meeting the eligibility criteria. It's not like a government grant program where there's a committee that is and competitively adjudicating the program. This is run by the CRA, administered by the CRA. It's a 15% to 35% tax credit, depending on the type of company you are. We'll get into a little bit more of that in the meantime, but it is a broad-based grassroots tax support program for scientific research and experimental development. And 99% of the claims out there are not on the scientific research side, but on the experimental development side. So this is designed for companies that are developing their new technology in an experimental way. And so we'll get into a little bit more of the criteria later on, but that's the essence of this fantastic program.
That's a great summary. Thank you for that. And I know, a lot of people equate innovation with SR&ED, and maybe that's really the first myth about the program, isn't it?
It really is, Jim, because it's funny that as being touted as the Canada's largest innovation support program, CRA will actually use the innovation as an example of what's not eligible, even though they turn around and put on their website that it's the largest innovation support program out there. The reason is that you can innovate by being the first to do something. You can innovate by being using your routine knowledge of whether it's in engineering or a science area of some kind. You can use your routine and existing capabilities to innovate. But the SR&ED program is not that. The SR&ED program is about experimentation and having some development in your knowledge, some advancement in your knowledge, some advancement in your capabilities, and experimenting to get there. So there has to be some sort of barrier that you're overcoming to increase your knowledge of the technology that is the subject of the SR&ED claim. So I know it's kind of backwards, but that's the first myth covered check mark.
Yeah, it's easy to believe that the SR&ED program is only available for, pure scientific research. Like, I'm picturing people walking around in lab coats, looking into microscopes and mixing up chemicals. But that's really another myth, isn't it, Jeff?
Yeah, that's true, Jim. It's the program isn't strictly related and specific to the scientific research side, although that's what many people believe. But the program is much broader than that, and I mean, it's built into the name, scientific research and experimental development. And as David pointed out earlier, you know, it's the experimental development side that is the huge chunk of the claimants every year that claim the shred into the shred program. And that can be anywhere from what we call shop floor shred, which is, you know, a small business operator in some sort of manufacturing setting, doing stuff on the fly, making changes to their processes, to their equipment, trying to eke out those improvements, trying to understand, you know, why am I only getting 100 widgets instead of 150 widgets? So, I mean, that end of it is really, you know, a big part of it, you know, going into, you know, tool and die industry, going into automotive, going into all these different areas where, you know, you think, you know, is it really, you know, science going on here? Well, I said it is more than just science. There is that experimental development side that is really important in the program.
That's true, Jeff. And it's interesting that the Act actually goes out of its way to say that incremental improvements are also, so, you know, it doesn't have to be earth shattering. It can be incremental improvements to your knowledge of your own products and processes that is the subject of R&D. So it doesn't have to be a brand new thing. It can be incremental.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think a lot of people fall into the trap of thinking that to be eligible for the program, you have to somehow like revolutionize your industry or create a brand new project, but it just isn't true, is it?
That's true. Yeah. I mean, there is no requirement for that eureka moment to have a project be eligible for SHRED. As it's pointed out in the Income Tax Act, it does relate to incremental improvements. So it can be, you know, you're increasing from 2% to 5% improvement. I mean, that in and of itself is an advancement. And the way you got there is what really defines whether the project is eligible. And we'll get into those details in a few moments. But yeah, it, you know, you don't have to be the first in the industry. You don't have to be the first to discover something. You know, you can have improvements. You can advance your knowledge base just fine without being the first.
So your project doesn't have to be original necessarily. And if you're maybe not the first, you know, organization to face a particular type of technological uncertainty, that doesn't mean you're out of luck.
Yeah, that's correct. Dave, you have a comment there?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. What is important is the capabilities of the of your company, and not what your competitors might have done already. So, for example, if your competitor has been able to achieve a certain objective technically themselves, well, if that's out in the public domain, well, then it's not SHRED. But if it's IP of your competitors, then you are quite within your rights to claim SHRED for the development work that gets you to achieve that objective. So that's something to consider. It's really what's in the public domain that matters in terms of whether or not something is eligible for the SHRED.
So let's pause from the myths for a second and just talk about what the criteria really are. So, I mean, Jeff, what are the true criteria to be eligible for a SHRED?
Yeah, so there definitely are you know, rules that we have to follow and eligibility requirements to determine whether a project is eligible or not. And you know, it's evolved over the years. The biggest change happened back in 1998, landmark tax court case, in which what we call the five questions were developed, and those all relate to, you know, aspects of what is the uncertainty. You establish an uncertainty. Did you, you know, generate a hypothesis to try and test that? You know, did you collect data? Did you do it systematically? Did you have an advancement? You know, more or less, you know, paraphrasing what those five questions are, and that's been the guiding focus, you know, since then, both in CRA and within industry, is, you know, that as SHRED providers. A couple of years ago, CRA kind of modified that a little bit, and they went to what was called the how and the why questions. So that's kind of the new basis that we're going on. The five questions that are still existing, they're underlying the how and the why. But that's, you know, that's what we're now going into. And just to briefly go over the why you're undertaking the work is you're really looking to overcome a scientific or technological uncertainty and to achieve a technological scientific advancement. And the how side of the equation is, okay, you know, how are you going about doing that? And we need to establish that there is this systematic approach. And people will remember from their high school science days, we call it the scientific method, where you have your hypothesis, you test your hypothesis through experimentation, you look at your results, you draw your conclusions and you go back and say, did I answer that question? I mean, strictly speaking, that's the process. We recognize as shred providers that not every business, you know, thinks that way, only your sort of really, you know, pure science research organizations, but really fundamentally it comes down to, you know, on the how side, that that the approach you're taking is systematic, that you have a method to your madness, as we say, that that you're doing it a certain way. And as a result of that, you know, you're gaining new knowledge. There is this gap between where, you know, the objective of the project and what you know, and you're trying to close that gap by undertaking the work. And that's how we determine project eligibility in a nutshell.
I'll just add that, you know, when I go into companies with, you know, technically oriented people, they tend to be following that process anyway, whether they recognize it or not. There's always that conceptual moment, how do I solve this problem? They set a hypothesis on how to fix it, whether or not they actually write that down and have that clearly set out. They're following that process. So the problem is not that. The problem is getting it laid out in a way that CRA can really understand it. But, you know, by and large, when you work with engineers or technical staff, they are following that scientific method when they're trying to solve challenges and problems in their technology.
Yeah. And in some cases, you know, we'll have clients that say, oh, well, we did trial and error. And, you know, we always say, well, trial and error are kind of, you know, voodoo words in CRA land, and we don't want to do that. But really, they still have a method for doing
CRA.
It. Yeah. The CRA swear word. Yeah. There's the five words you can't say in front of the CRA. And that's what, but it's the, you know, it's the idea that they're doing it systematically. They have, there's a reason why they're doing it. They're not just throwing everything against the wall and seeing what sticks. And that's our job is to really tease that out and say, yeah, you are actually doing it systematically. You are meeting that how objective. So that's the benefit.
Yeah, they always have an idea or a set of ideas that they think might solve it, or a path that they want to go down. And then they investigate, they do some experiments, they get the results, and that informs their next decision of what the next step is going to be. So they're doing that naturally, like Dave and Jeff have said. And it's just a matter of getting them to think that way and opening up the doors a little bit and spinning the project around so we see it the right way and present it to CRA so they can find that it's eligible.
Well, thank you all for clarifying that. I know a lot of these myths do tend to center around the criteria, you know, for qualifying for the tax credit. So it's great to get more clarity on that. I know another myth that sort of floats around out there is that your project has to be successful in order to qualify for the tax credit. Maybe explain why that's not true at all.
Yeah, so, you know, really the fundamentals of the SHRED program is all about advancing science and technology, making a technological advancement or advancing science in some way. You know, people seem to think, well, you know, my project isn't eligible because I wasn't successful at it. And for the purposes of SHRED, it doesn't really matter. What we're really looking at is, what is that advancement? And when a project fails, oftentimes that's a better indicator for SHRED because there was a barrier that you couldn't overcome. You couldn't overcome that uncertainty. And that really, you know, in some ways, a failed project is a much stronger project for SHRED. And we always try and tease that out when we talk to our clients to say, okay, tell me about the things that didn't work. They always want to talk about what did work. Okay, that's great. Tell us about the things that didn't work, because, you know, that's equally as eligible. And in the eyes of CRA, you know, success and failure are the same when it comes down to SHRED. They really want to know that process you took, that path you took, that knowledge you gained, that advancement you made. So if a project doesn't work, it's still an advancement because you now know, don't do that again next time. So, you know, that's why we always say, tell us everything and we'll go from there.
So as long as you're willing to admit failure, it's actually to your benefit, because, you know, it obviously shows that you were facing that technological uncertainty, I guess, as long as it's documented well.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's the other aspect is to maintain that documentation. But absolutely, you know, if there's a failure in it, that tells us that there's something significant here. It wasn't straightforward.
It pays to lose sometimes, I guess.
Indeed.
Very interesting. What about whether or not a project is finished? Does that have any impact on a SHRED claim? I think that there's a misconception out there that your project sort of has to be done before you can go ahead and claim this funding.
No, that's definitely not the case. Because SHRED, you know, looks at it on a tax year by tax year basis, it is perfectly fine for, you know, if you have a project that, you know, began in a particular year and continues for, you know, multiple years after it, because we're looking at a particular point in time. a particular taxation year for the company. And as long as there's work that's occurring during that time period that meets the eligibility requirements, even if the project isn't done or hasn't been completed, we can still claim that project because we articulated as, yeah, we started it here, but because of the nature of it, we're going to be continuing this on into the future, and you claim the project in that specific year and the particular costs. So yeah, absolutely. A project doesn't have to begin and end to be SHRED eligible.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that had to be a myth because obviously some of these projects will span multiple tax years, and frankly, larger projects could go on for years or decades.
Exactly. I work, one of my bigger clients is a pharmaceutical company out in the East Coast, and they, there's a project that we have been claiming for several years now, and that's the nature of the pharma business, is where a project comes up, it can last 5, 6, 7 years, because that as long as you articulate that you have not overcome your uncertainty, that project continues. Once that uncertainty is overcome and completed, the SHRED is complete. So it's definitely the case that some of these larger projects can span multiple years.
And some of them can morph into another uncertainty. So halfway through the resolution, trying to resolve an uncertainty, new uncertainties may manifest themselves, and then you've got a new project, or you may have a side project, or you may continue it as the same project. But once those uncertainties shift around, there may be opportunities to have multiple projects out of it as well.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it's not a myth, but I was wondering, like, what happens if you have multiple projects on the go at the same time? Does that have an impact on your claim, or?
No, not at all. It's, because of the, SHRED is an entitlement program. So as long as you've done the work and we articulate the projects are eligible, you're entitled to claim the costs. You can have multiple projects, claim multiple different projects. Each project might have its own uncertainty, its own TU, as we call it. Or there can be multiple projects that have a common theme that runs through them. And, in certain cases, we can combine those projects into a much larger SHRED project. And in many cases, that gives it a much stronger footing from a SHRED perspective. And that all ties in together as a common technical uncertainty or technological uncertainty. And you go from there. So, you're not limited to one project. You can have multiple projects on the go, claim them separately. We look at each one in turn and see if it makes sense, and we go from there.
Very good. Now, what if somebody else, say another corporation, is paying you to do the work, or maybe perhaps they're covering your cost? I think a lot of people feel like that means you can't make the SHRED claim. Only the company that's paying those costs can. Is that true?
No, that's not true at all. I mean, sometimes it's true that the cost need to be the payment needs to be deducted from your costs, but this is a huge one. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from clients, oh, we can't claim that project. We did that for a customer. That was customer work, or so-and-so paid us for it. So there are specific rules in the Income Tax Act, the contract payment rules, just around this. So the first thing is that the rules are there to make sure that two different Canadian companies don't claim the credit for the same work. So in the case where you have maybe a foreign customer who's paying you into Canada, or a foreign parent or a foreign subsidiary, a sister company, a non-arm's length company paying you to do the work, you don't have to deduct that foreign payment from your SHRED claim as a contract payment received. The other aspect is, even if it's a Canadian company, if it's non-arm's length, if it's a sister company, a parent company, some other associated company in Canada, and they're paying you for the work, what we do there is we claim each company's contribution, the work that they're doing, in the original company at their cost. So if two companies under the same group are involved in a project, we claim their costs separately in the originating company where the work was done. And if one company, all they're doing is paying the other company, there's no deduction anywhere for that payment going across, but it would allow potentially the transfer of expenditures from the performer to the payer if it's better for tax. So there's layers in there. I mean, and another one is, if you are being paid by that arm's length Canadian company who's your true customer, not related to you in any way, then we're looking at a few criteria that we need to analyze, which are well established in case law and in CRA policy. The two biggest ones are, at the end of the day, who owns the IP that was generated out of that project? That's a big one. If you can demonstrate IP ownership, that's a factor in your favor. The other big one is financial risk. So if you're on a time and materials uncapped project and you're receiving money, that shows that the financial risk was not with you. It was with the payor. If it's a fixed fee contract and you have to deliver, then that would stand to be your financial risk because you're at risk of an overage and not being able to recover all your costs. Those are the two big ones. We also look at what was the actual deliverable. Was there a knowledge transfer? Was it enough information for the company to go out and copyright or patent that information? Or was it a final drawing or a schematic or a device that you provided to them and you maintain the ability to use all the knowledge that you gained in your business and they weren't paying you for that knowledge gain? So remember, we've been talking a lot about, you're at a certain knowledge level and the shred is about gaining that new knowledge, expanding capabilities. If you're not transferring that knowledge, that's an indicator that it's your shred as well. There's a lot of nuances in there, but the short answer is it might be the case that it reduces your shred claim to the extent that you got paid for it. If you're dealing with an arm's length Canadian company as your customer or payor, but it's not always the case even then.
Well, it sounds like there would definitely be some accounting and potential cost allocation and a lot of work to do. But your point is you're not automatically ineligible just because somebody else is contributing to the cost associated with the project. Is that fair to say?
Brian said that there's a short answer to that question. I don't think there's a short answer to that.
It didn't sound that short to me, actually.
Complicated area of this tax law, but safe to say you got it right. I mean, you are eligible to make a claim. It's just how that deduction of revenue and whether that deduction of revenue takes place. But you can almost always make the claim.
Yeah. Okay, now what if the other person contributing to the project is the government? Say you're receiving some type of government funding for the project. Yeah. Does that rule out a shred claim? I think a lot of people feel it does.
They certainly do, and there's two aspects to it. There's a provision in the Act called government assistance. So any other government assistance reduces the shred expenditure base that you're dealing with. But there's a number of things to consider. One is most government funding programs are not going to, that are funding expenditures, let's say salary. Typically, the funding programs are only going to cover a third or a half. And to the extent that that is the case, you get to claim the other part of it. Secondly, again, using the salary example, you may get overhead on top of your salary, and that government assistance may not be taken off the salary component. So always best to make the shred claim and deduct the government assistance off of it. Secondly, government funding isn't always for the specific narrow definition of shred. So government may fund an R&D project. Some aspects of that project may be R&D, but they may not be shred. So that's another consideration to avoid some of that grind of the government assistance on the shred. For example, some R&D support programs fund late-stage commercialization expenditures, capital, some marketing expenditures. None of those are eligible for the shred program. And so those costs that from the government grant do not have to grind your shred. So we analyze it to look for that overlap and try to minimize it based on the law. But it's always best to make the shred claim and then comply with the legislation by deducting the government assistance to in as minimal a grind as possible.
Yeah, another thing to consider there is if you say your government assistance was in the form of a no interest loan or a conditionally repayable loan, and you didn't even know if you're going to have to repay it. If you claim your shred project and then deduct your government assistance, and then in time, you need to repay that loan. As you make those repayments, you can claim that repaid government assistance on your future shred claim, but only if you made the claim for the project in the first place and deducted the government assistance. So then in a future year, when you start repaying that loan, then you can claim those repayments. So it really does pay to look at your SRED project and what your government assistance is, and making sure that you're looking at it holistically and making the grind as much as you can, as Dave was saying, minimizing that overlap, but then also consider downstream, if you claim it now, you might not get the benefit, but you likely will in a few years if you have to start repaying it.
That's a great point, Brian, because so many times I've seen clients come 5 years later and that's now too late to make the claim. But had they made it on time, yeah, they wouldn't have got the benefit right then, but they could reconstitute the benefit as they pay back the loan. So very important consideration and government assistance.
So bottom line is still eligible, more work to do. I'm seeing a trend here, actually, with SRED. But that's very good. I know there's a few other myths out there that have to do with the administration of the program. And one of them is that, you know, it's too late to file a claim if you've already filed your tax return for a year or years in which the expenses were incurred. Is that true?
Not at all, Jim. There's a statutory deadline for your SRED claim, which is 18 months after your tax year end for corporations in Canada. And at any point in time up till that 18-month deadline, you can file an amendment to your tax return to include the SRED claim. You can change a SRED claim that was already filed. You can add to it. You can modify it. All fair game within your 18-month deadline. There's no restriction other than that on your timing. Back in the years ago, there was minister's discretion if you had a really good reason why you filed it late. But I will say, as a fair warning to everyone listening, that is an absolutely hard deadline unless they pass some law in the meantime to relieve it. As they did in COVID, they extended the 18-month deadline temporarily during COVID because it was an unusual hardship that they recognized. But other than passing legislation to change that deadline, there's no discretion to extend it whatsoever. So bottom line, 18 months after year end, 12 months after your normal T2 deadline, get your SRED claim in if you want it.
That's important to know. So I guess within that hard deadline, it would be a real shame if you let one of the other myths, say, about the eligibility for the program, kind of delay you in taking a look at the opportunity. Because, you know, you have to meet that deadline, don't you?
Well, exactly. I mean, you can spin around for months trying to make something perfect or try to get everything in a row. Sometimes you have to do what you can do and get it filed before your deadline. And if you still have time afterwards and something else comes to light, some project that you missed, there's always the ability to go in and add it back in at that point in time.
Now, what if you've maybe already filed a SRED claim for a particular project? You know, is that absolutely the end of the story? Maybe you've already received the tax credit. Is it too late at that point to review it or adjust it?
It's not. It's not at all. You can add projects. You can add costs to projects. You can do anything like that within the 18 months. I would say, I mean, you asked about if a project has been reviewed and or you got your money for it already. If you resubmit that project, make sure the juice is worth the squeeze because you're going to open it up to another review. I mean, once it's been assessed by CRA, they're normally not going to go back and look at it again. It's not in their interest to spend time on it at that point. But if you make a subsequent adjustment request to that project, it's all fair game again. They might decide to review it. So you might want to make sure you're making a meaningful addition to it before you do that.
And in your experience, does that happen a lot? Like if you add significantly to a previous claim, my thinking is they would definitely want to take a look at those additions. Is that what you guys see out in the field?
Yeah, it's one risk factor, right? I mean, they do any electronic screening when they get it and the system will flag for risk factors. One would be an unusual increase year over year, or if you had submitted a claim and then there was a significant increase. They look at the timing of the claim as well. The closer it is to the 18-month deadline, they consider it risky, like it might be rushed or last minute. If it's filed on time with a T2, that tends to be a lower risk factor. Certain expenditures, like if you have a lot of contractors and almost no labor or zero labor in your claim, that would be a risk. There's a lot of them that we have kind of sussed out over the years from what they look at during reviews. And there's a lot of factors that we don't know what they look at. But even if they do flag it, it's up to someone looking at the claim in the context of reading it and looking at the expenditures to decide if they're going to pass it through at that point or push it out for a review. So that's kind of the process at CRA, the electronic screening. It'll pop up some queries, some flags. Someone will look at it and make the call if it needs to go to the field or if they can let it go. And if it goes to the field, then you're going to have a science reviewer and or a financial reviewer coming to see you either virtually or in person to take a look at your claim and validate the work and the expenditures.
Okay, this is great. This is great information. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, sorry, I just going to add to that, to Brian's point. I mean, I have a real-world example. One of my larger clients, we went in, we started off as a new engagement with them, and we identified, you know, a project that the previous provider hadn't captured, and this was a $100,000 worth of expenditure project. So we went in and we amended the previous year's return, added the project, and sure enough, it was reviewed by CRA. But, you know, once we set out, here's what the project's about, give us the details, went through the whole, song and dance. They're like, yep, that sounds good. And we've been fine ever since. So they recognized, you know, we made sure we reopened the T2, made sure that that was a quality project, and then the client understood the risk, and we were successful in the end. So it does happen, and we have been successful.
So there is still hope even after filing. That's really good to know. I was going to say, this is great information. I've got one more, what I think is a myth, to run by you. And that is that it's not worthwhile to file a shred claim if you don't actually pay any taxes. I don't know, maybe your company's in a loss position, you're in a startup phase, something like that. Is that true?
Not always. So I'm going to say it depends.
Okay.
So there's a couple of ways that you can still cash out your shred. One is if you're a Canadian-controlled private company, a CCPC, and the size of your company is within size limits, which is on your, if you look at your balance sheet, they're looking at under $10 million on your balance sheet, and you're going to get a refundable credit. Between 10 and 50 million, you're going to get a little bit less of a credit, but you're still going to get refundable money. So if you're in that startup phase, you're not a hugely capital intense business in your CCPC, there's a 35% refundable credit on up to the first $3 million of shred expenditures. And as your company grows in size up to 50 million, that $3 million limit comes down. So there's still money there. And it's a very generous credit. I mean, 35% as a refund for not paying any tax. It's perfect for those startups that are spending money, but they're incurring debt, or they're getting investment capital coming in, and they're spending it without making any revenue or paying any tax. So they can get that shred money coming in to fund that development phase of their company. Another thing is that many provinces have refundable credits on top of the federal credit. So if you think about the Atlantic provinces, except for PEI, there's a 15% credit refundable for any claimant, CCPC, public company, foreign controlled, anyone can get that. In Quebec, there's a refundable credit based on labor and contract labor. In Ontario, there's a size-tested refundable credit. In Alberta, there's a size-tested refundable credit that's open to everyone. And in many provinces, those CCPCs also qualify for refundable treatment, whereas their public or large company or foreign-controlled company counterparts wouldn't. So depending on what kind of company you are, how big you are, and what province you're in, there can be money there. The other thing I'll throw out is, even if you don't get the refund right away when you're making your shred claim, there's a 20-year carry forward for the non-refundable credits. So if you look at what
20 years, that's a pretty long time.
Yeah, 20 tax years. Yeah. So, I mean, it sits on your books. If you think that you're going to be profitable in that time and chew through your losses, there you're going to get those tax credits against your future income tax. You can also carry it back 3 years. So if you're in a dip year and you had profits in the past, you can carry it back to relieve those previously paid taxes. If you're a startup, you're looking at carrying the non-refundables forward. But the other kind of semi-invisible to many people benefit of the shred program is that anything that you claim for shred, so if you're claiming your labor, your subcontractors, materials, et cetera, those are things that you would have normally deducted for tax purposes and would be part of a non-capital loss on your tax return going forward. And those expire after 20 years if you don't use them. When you claim it for shred, it goes out of that pool and into your shred pool. So it gets segregated from those non-capital losses, which are subject to expiry, and it goes into your SRED pool, which is completely discretionary. You can take it any time in the current year or any future year. You can't carry it back like you can with losses, but you can carry it forward. And the huge benefit of that for a lot of companies is that's an indefinite life carry forward. There is no expiry. So you can leave those expenditures sitting there for future deductions and use up other tax attributes that would expire, like those 20-year carry forwards on your ITCs, for example. You can use those up first before they expire and still have your SRED pool piggy bank to grind your future income even after 20 years. So depending on what your SRED claim size is going to be and what your financial outlook is, and if you're playing the long game and you want those deductions into the future, the SRED process has a lot of benefits for a lot of different companies that can result in cash today, cash next year, cash 20 plus years down the road in the form of offsets of income. So it really is a worthwhile consideration for any company that's doing work to improve their tech or their processes.
Yeah, I'll just add that it's a tax asset that may not be on your balance sheet as well, especially, you know, let's say I'm an early stage startup company and my exit is going to be either a strategic acquirer or a venture capital is something. And those tax assets may have value to a potential acquirer. And those those carry forwards of the tax credits, if you're in the same or similar business, are going to carry forward to an acquirer. So they survive mergers, acquisitions, and so they have value in and of themselves if you're thinking of selling the company or you have a particular exit strategy for your company. You don't have to wait the 20 years if you're not taxable. If there's a restructuring or a liquidity event that's going to give rise to somebody seeing value in those tax credits down the road.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, I've had a number of clients approach me who had never claimed SRED, but now they're thinking of an imminent exit in a couple of years. And they want the value on their balance sheet. And if they'd started earlier, they would have had so much more. But yeah, they definitely have value to an acquirer, maybe not dollar for dollar, depending on what's there, but they definitely have value to an acquirer and will put money into their shareholders' pockets.
Yeah.
Great explanation and discussion, David and Brian. I guess we'll call that last one maybe not a myth, but a lack of understanding about Canadian tax law.
But, or an opportunity.
Exactly, an opportunity. I mean, great information. Brian, David, Jeff, thank you so much for your insights today. You know, in dispelling some of these myths, we may have raised a few questions. What's the best way for a listener to get in touch with you or to contact your team if they have any questions?
Jim, we'd be happy to, all three of us, we'll send out our emails and our phone numbers. Happy to have a Teams call, happy to visit. Now that we can do that, we love going out to clients now and potential clients and meeting new technology companies. So we'd love to hear from you.
Okay, sounds good. And of course, if someone listening is a Ryan client, they can also start with the Ryan Tax Direct line. You can call 1-800-667-1600 or email taxdirect@ryan.com. Thank you three again for your great insights today. It was very informative.
Thanks, Jim. Pleasure.
Thanks, Jim.
That's it for this episode of Ryan Talks Tax. Please let us know what you think about the podcast. You can send your questions, comments, or suggestions to events@ryan.com. Thanks for listening.